Love music. Live sport. Pole Position with Andy Alston and Adam Todd on Rock Sport Radio.
Hello and welcome to Pole Position here on Rock Sport Radio. It's Andy Alston with you alongside Adam Todd. We're broadcasting live on DAB Digital Radio across Central Scotland on TuneIn and online, talking motorsport from 8 until 9. So on the show this week, who's up to par in the F1 season so far? We wonder if Lorenzo can deliver on the Honda, and Rally is back as Tanak leads the pack. All this and more on Pole Position. Now, Formula One might be on its summer break, with Lewis Hamilton enjoying a 62-point advantage over his Mercedes teammate Valtteri Bottas. Red Bull's Max Verstappen is third in the standings, while it's McLaren who lead the midfield. But one of the big stories in the sport this week is the first glimpse of what the cars will look like in the future, with the 2021 cars being revealed for the first time. Well, joining us on Pole Position to have a brief recap at this and the season so far, delighted to welcome back Scott Douglas from our friends at the Checkered Flag. Scott, what's your initial reaction to the new cars that have been revealed?
I must say, I was quite pleasantly surprised at how good they look. Normally when Formula One tries to slow cars down, it makes them ugly at the same time. Think of 2009 when they introduced those awful rear wings that were high and skinny. Now we've got a sort of a low-down, racy-looking car. So aesthetically, it looks great, but what will really matter is how it actually performs on the track and how it will actually affect the dirty air that's following the cars and how much it will improve over taking.
And Scott, it almost seems like a bit of a throwback in some respects. You know, my initial impressions when I had a look at it, particularly from the front end, it felt like an early 90s Formula One car. I was getting visions of Alain Prost's Ferrari, particularly at the front. You know, maybe that was a bit of nostalgia kicking around, maybe Sean Mage now, who knows. But, you know, certainly at the front, it's pretty menacing. But it's got that kind of modern twist as well, you know, the kind of covers over the front wings as well. A bit of a nod to some of the LMP1 cars that we see these days.
Yeah, exactly, and I agree with you on the sort of the nostalgic element of it. I always thought when they brought the huge rear wheels back, that really brought back the 80s for me. And you're right, that new front end where the front nose is now attached to the front wing. In the mid-90s, Benetton pioneered dropping that front wing below the nose in order to encourage more air underneath the car. The new ones will make sure that the nose is attached to that front wing, reducing ground effect through the floor, which normally creates a lot of the dirty air. But yeah, I like the look of that. I like the fact that the front wing is simplified but still looks good. I think the current front wings on Formula One cars are works of art. I mean, they look like razor blades, but they are absolutely beautiful, in my opinion. But obviously, they are very sensitive to dirty air and they limit overtaking. And Formula One said they were going to change them. Actually, I think they found a good way around making them simplistic but actually still look like they're racing. Yeah, personally, I'm quite encouraged by it. I think it looks a lot better than I thought it was going to look.
Scott, one part of the car I'm kind of struggling to get my head around a little bit, I have to be honest, is the rear end. You know, the way the rear wing looks, it's a completely different concept to what we've had over the last few years in Formula One. And again, I dare say that's all going back to reducing that dirty air and making it easier for the drivers to overtake.
Exactly. Pat Simmons was saying that they were at the wind tunnel they were using, they put the model at the very front of the wind tunnel, as far forward as they could put it, because they weren't particularly interested in the forces being exerted on the car. They were more interested in what the air after the car looked like, which is a fascinating way, I mean, a completely different way of looking at it compared to usual. But that's what they're interested in. They want to make sure that that rear wing, all the air coming off the car, isn't dirty, it isn't turbulent, and there's not lots of vortexes coming off the wingtips. They want it as clean as possible, so that when you've got another car behind it, it's not throwing the aerodynamics off from that car, and it's actually possible to drive close together and actually race together. I mean, if you think with superbikes, how close they are able to follow to each other, because there's very little aerodynamics involved compared to a Formula One car, it's obviously never going to be as close as that, but you want to get it somewhere close to that, where if you're the faster driver, you can pass. It's not an element of, well, you're fast, but you actually need to have a delta over the car in front of over a second to actually make an overtaking maneuver. That's when it gets dull, and that's when you end up with races like we had in France this year.
Scott, how important do you think it is for Formula One and, of course, the new owners, Liberty Media, to get this car right? Yes, it's kind of initial concepts at the moment, and I dare say the final version will be somewhat different when it hits the track once the designers put their creative design philosophies on the respective cars. But how important is it that Formula One ensures that this set of regulations can see the sport thrive in the coming years?
They've been talking about it. They've been really bigging up this rule change. They've been, you know, heralding this as the new era of Formula One that will change everything. If it doesn't, you know, they are going to have to really eat their words. They've bet a lot on this working. And I think every time there's going to be a bad race between now and then, they're going to say, well, don't worry about it. 2021, everything will change. And there's no guarantee of that. As you mentioned, you know, it's the job of an F1 designer to find a way around these rules. They're trying to take downforce off the car. Mark my words, these designers, the sponsors, Adrian Newey, will be working your way endlessly as we speak, trying to find a way around these rules to get that downforce back. So it's not a guarantee, but I think it is important. What I think will be more important for Liberty Media is how they deal with the cost cap that they want to bring in for around the same time. You've got a lot of the smaller teams complaining about how much it is to race in Formula One, that there's no way they'll possibly keep up with the bigger teams because of their bigger budget. If Liberty Media can get that right, they could actually really, that could be the silver bullet. That could really sort out the future of Formula One for decades to come.
Scott, do you think a cap is feasible, though? Because, you know, you look at what the likes of Ferrari and Mercedes now as well are contributing to the sport in terms of marketing, in terms of their gravitas and how they attract fans and maintain the prestige of Formula One. Is it realistic for Liberty to say, right, well, you're all working off X amount and like it or lump it, you know, considering these teams have all got their own respective sponsors who contribute a significant sum of money as well, surely there is an element of, this is the pinnacle of motorsport and it's up to you to be as good as you are off the track as you are on the track as well.
Exactly, and I think what we ideally want to get to is a position where if you are the smartest at spending your money, you're the fastest Formula One team. We've seen Force India outperform their budget for many years. This year has been not as good, but previous years, considering their budget, they've been further up the grid compared to bigger spending teams around them. However, let's face it, they're never going to compete with a Ferrari or a Red Bull or a Mercedes because their budget is a fourth or a fifth of the size of those teams. A cost cap in Formula One has been discussed for many years. Max Mosley was a huge proponent of it, but never managed to force it through. I think it will be very difficult to do, mainly because, as Formula One teams, the big teams especially, have highlighted in the past, it all depends on how you put the accounting through. For example, Mercedes could put a lot of their design team into their manufacturing business or into the engine department. They could be producing work that benefits the Formula One team, but they might not have them on the books of the Formula One team. How do you get around that? How do you get around people being clever with how they, you know, how they account for all the staff and all the spending happens? It will be difficult. But if you could even reduce it by a fifth, you know, of what the top teams are currently spending, not only would it make it more competitive with the smaller teams having a bit more of a chance, I think what you'd also do, which is what really matters for the future of the sport, is stop something happening like we saw in 2008 with the financial crash, and we saw a lot of big manufacturers just deciding that they could not afford to do Formula One anymore. We had BMW, Toyota, Honda, all dropped out of the sport immediately because they just could not afford to do it anymore. We have to avoid that situation happening again, because that's when actually Formula One comes closest to stopping as a sport, is when there aren't enough teams to actually compete. So if they can get it right, it'd be great, but you're right, it is going to be difficult.
Hi, Scott. Adam here. I completely agree with you with regards to a cost cap, because at the moment, you know, you mentioned it, a lot of teams that are struggling just now. I mean, Williams, for example, every year, you know, we're discussing their financial problems, and they're a team that have given so much to Formula One over the years, and we do not want to be losing teams with a rich heritage and history in the sport like them. And at the moment, you know, Formula One, it is two classes. Mercedes, Ferrari, Red Bull are really in a league of their own. McLaren and Renault, yes, they've got big money, but apart from that, you know, the rest of the teams just do not have the cash to compete, and we don't want to end up in a situation where there's effectively three different classes. I mean, we've got Formula 1.5, don't we, at the moment, you know. And, you know, it's just not good for the sport that, you know, there is just no opportunity for these teams. I mean, how many times are we going to see drivers saying, oh, you know, we're turning up and seventh is the best we can hope for? I don't feel that is right.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same page. When you see people like Kevin Magnussen crossing the line in fifth place earlier on this season, don't get me wrong, great drive from him, great finish, but he celebrated it like a win, because for Haas, that is a win. They're not going to win a race this season. They're not going to win a race next season unless something drastic happens. So fifth place, those days, are the best they can hope for. It's sad to see a driver like Kevin Magnussen, who in his junior Formula E got used to winning in every single series, suddenly celebrating fifth like it is a victory. We need to have more competition up front, and while the costs are as they are, you're right, we're never going to have that. And you're right, when you talk about manufacturers dropping out of the sport after the financial crash, the teams that actually sustain it are the heritage teams. It's McLaren, it's Williams, it's those teams who this is what they do. They don't do anything else. Okay, that changed for McLaren in recent years, but Williams are a racing team. They exist to go racing, and if we lose teams by them, then we are in a lot of trouble.
Scott, one of the criticisms I've heard a lot of people say about Formula One over the last few years is it's very hard for one of the teams to do a Leicester City, in effect, come from nowhere and go on and win the championship. In reality, yeah, how feasible is that for Formula One, and how do we strike a balance between, you know, Ferrari, Mercedes dominating and then all of a sudden Racing Point win the championship next year? Because if we start seeing a little bit of randomness coming through, dare I say a little bit what we've had with a number of different winners and race winners in Formula E this year, it can be a little bit challenging for the more casual fan to keep a hold of things.
Exactly, and it's an interesting comparison you made there to Formula E, because I very much agree that I think that what you want to see is the best teams and the best drivers prospering. And when you see every race a different result or a different winner, you start thinking, well, is that because that driver was the best driver on the day, or was it just luck, or was it just, you know, the right set of circumstances with track temperatures and tyres and things? And it does, I agree. I don't think it makes it as easy to follow. I think that what you will end up doing, and actually it will still be the case, the big teams will still be the best teams if you introduce the cost cap, because it will be about how well you spend. And over the course of a season, if you introduce a good car in January, you should have a good car for the whole season. It's like you talk about Leicester City. I suppose the closest we had to that was Brawn in 2009. Yeah. Okay, they designed that car using the money of Honda, but they got into that double diffuser concept that they aced it compared to the other teams around them, and they ended up winning the championship on it. Now, that was deserved. That was a great season. You know, don't get me wrong, the first few races, if you weren't a Jenson Button fan, were slightly dull, but, you know, it was exciting to see a new team emerge and have that sort of success. But you're right, and you couldn't see a Leicester City in Formula One. You know, it's just not going to happen. If you're not from the top three teams at the moment, you aren't going to win a Formula One race. And the thing that concerns me more is that if someone else develops a double diffuser concept at the moment, the other teams have so much money and there's so many races in a season now, six or seven races in, they'll have caught up that gap and they'll start to overtake the teams who actually came up with the original thought in the first place to actually develop and actually outthink the bigger spending teams. That's what I worry about more. But yeah, unfortunately, Formula One is money driven at the moment, and unless we get a cost cap, that's not going to change.
And there's some interesting comments there about the number of different winners in Formula E and how it's been a bit too many, but I completely disagree with that. What Formula One needs now more than anything is unpredictability, because we just don't have it. Okay, the past four races have been thrilling, but for the past five seasons, it's Mercedes win after Mercedes win, and then maybe once every five races, you'll maybe see a Ferrari pop up or a Red Bull pop up.
Adam, that's not Mercedes' fault.
It's not Mercedes' fault, and I'm not blaming them, but also it does go back to the likes of the cost. And I'm arguing that unpredictability is a good thing, whereas you were trying to say it's a bad thing. I mean, look, 2012 for me, I mean, that was just an incredible season. And, you know, we saw
Yeah, I mean, was that nine in the first nine?
Yeah, seven out of seven. Not quite. Hopefully we get nine soon.
I think I was thinking Formula E, actually, because they had nine in the first nine, didn't they? But yeah.
And I think that's good, because it was different teams as well. I mean, you look at Sauber as well that season. Kobayashi got a podium. Perez was on the podium a few races. Obviously, Maldonado's win in Spain, and that's a Williams win for the first time, I think it was since 2004. And, you know, just different teams were able to compete with. And it didn't feel like it was two classes. Okay, you had the likes of Marussia, Caterham and HRT, and that was a disaster when those three teams really came in, wasn't it? All three of them have long gone and long been forgotten, unfortunately. But I think unpredictability is always good, and that is what sport needs, because you know, it would be great if we could see these teams get closer, but I just do not see it happen. And I think that is why we need a cost cap, because 2012 is by far and clear the best Formula One season for me, certainly, in recent years. Since the hybrid era, I wouldn't say any season has been unpredictable at all.
And you've just finished us all off there, Adam. Yeah, there's absolutely nothing point to say. I tell you what, I'll say on that one, right? You're arguing the point that lots of different winners is a good thing, right? We've got a situation where Lewis Hamilton has been doing very well recently. Obviously, let's not deny that. Nico Rosberg beat him. He beat him on merit. That, for me, was very entertaining, right? If you get to a stage where, you know, Lewis Hamilton wins three races, he falls away, and then wins it in Abu Dhabi at the end, you know, he's maybe won two races over the course of 20-odd. Is that great racing? For me, it's not. A championship's won over the length of a season, not the odd great result here and there, and so-and-so's won that race, and so-and-so's won the next one. That, for me, is very difficult, particularly for the casual fan to follow. And the reason I make that point up as well is because Formula One is doing all it can, and it must do all it can, to attract new fans to the sport. It's got to be easy for them to follow. They know who the established teams are. They know, right, okay, Mercedes, Ferrari, Red Bull, they're the front runners. Haas are maybe struggling, Williams are having a tough time, but let's hope they get better and we'll follow that journey. But it's unrealistic to say, right, do you know what? Let's have George Russell, he's going to win in Belgium. Let's have, Danny Kvyat, he'll win in Italy. Singapore, we'll give that to Pierre Gasly, why not? That's impossible for them to follow. It just simply does not work. And I'll put a further question to both of you. If you are in either Mercedes, Ferrari, Red Bull, and you know you've got a budget cap coming up in 2 years' time, and you know you can develop that car in 2 years' time, what are you going to do? Are you going to rest? Are you going to sit on your hands just now, or are you going to sit and develop so that come 2021, you'll still be the dominant force? So is a salary cap or a budget cap, whatever you want to call it, is that the way forward as of 2021? I highly doubt it. I don't think it will have as big an impact as everyone expects it to have. Yes, it's a great concept. It can perhaps level the playing field to a point. These teams aren't stupid, you know, they've got some of the finest minds in the world of motorsport. They'll find a way around this, and I absolutely guarantee you, you'll have Mercedes, Ferrari, Red Bull, they'll all be up the front come 2020.
And I still expect that, but also expect the other teams to at least be able, when they have an outstanding race, to at least finish on the podium on merit and not through luck, because at the moment it is just different classes, and the gulf is huge. And you know, you go back to yesteryear, you know, decades ago, and the gulf was huge between teams as well. But obviously we're talking in terms of recently, and we have been used to some smaller teams getting some good results. I go back to the 2012 season, and even with unpredictable, you always end up nearer towards the latter end of the season with, you know, a couple of championship contenders, maybe three or four, in there towards the mix. And you mentioned it's difficult for the casual fan to follow. That may be so, but also, is the casual fan really going to tune in to watch a Mercedes win every weekend? I don't think so. I mean, if I started watching Formula One just now, you know, and obviously we've been treated to four fantastic races, but if I started watching this season, I wouldn't have watched those four races, because I would have stopped watching after about race three or four. And that's the reality of the situation at the moment. What do you think, Scott?
Oh, the lines just dropped there. Scott, we'll get you back on in a little moment. The lines just dipped a little bit on our end. Adam, I'm sorry, I'm not letting this go. I'm just simply not letting this go. I think it's a risky situation. I take your point. Yeah, the first three races, or you might, it might be difficult for the casual fan to remain involved. But I've taken the stance personally.
Sport relies on unpredictability. That's what sells it. It's that going, even if perhaps it's a football, going to a football game and seeing the underdog win once in a blue moon. It's the unpredictability. If it was the same every weekend, you would just stop going.
Perhaps, but you know you've got your front runners. I'm not sitting looking going, oh, Lewis Hamilton, is he going to win this race this weekend? Of course we know he's going to be there or thereabouts. I'm looking at the revival of McLaren that we've had this year. I'm looking at how Red Bull are surprising and perhaps going to beat Ferrari to second place in the Constructors' Championship. There's more stories to motorsport than who's just fighting at the front. Yes, we are, you know, it's all about winning at the end of the day. But there's more to it. There's so many layers.
But the casual fan doesn't understand the layers at the moment.
Perhaps. And Scott joins us again now. Scott, what do you... Well, I'm just going to hand it over to you guys here. I'm going to take a quick break.
I agree with you on the unpredictability thing and the fact that there's always stories going on for me on that. That's why we love it. But the media, you can always tell from, you know, the television coverage how hard they're having to look to find the battles. What I found interesting was the Netflix documentary from last season, where they didn't have the participation of some of the top teams, so they tried to find some of the battles further down the grid. And some of them were quite interesting, some of them less so. But it never, ever is as good when you have two people battling it out at the top. It's always, people are always interested in the winners and who's going to write their name in the history books. And I'm sorry, but, you know, Haas edging out Renault this season isn't going to, you know, write any history books. That's going to be something that's forgotten by January next year. It's all about who's going to end up winning it. And as long as there's only one team, and in that team there's one driver who's far faster than his teammates, we happen to have this year, it's, you're just going to struggle to get new people involved.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Scott, at the moment. And you know, we mentioned earlier on, it is not Mercedes' fault at all that they are dominating. And I'm not trying to talk down Mercedes and saying, oh, they're boring. And I said earlier on in the show a few months ago, it's up to the other teams to develop. And my point basically is, Andy, that I don't want, you know, Mercedes, Red Bull and Ferrari to all of a sudden stop being the top three teams. I still expect them to be at the front, but I don't expect them, when they're having a bad day or have a crash and are still able to take a pit stop and still work their way through the field and still finish inside the top six, I don't expect that to be the case.
That I completely agree with you with. I think the days of, you know, you have to start from the pit lane, your race was over maybe perhaps in the 90s, early 2000s, of course further back as well. Now if a Ferrari or Mercedes is in the pit lane, it is realistic for them to target a podium. I absolutely 100% agree with you there. Where I have the issue is, for me, Formula One, it's the pinnacle of motorsport in the minds of many. You know, it's not one race. We don't focus on one race. It's part of a season. You keep referencing 2012 and how enjoyable that was. There wasn't one particular race that stood out there. It was the culmination of 20 odd races, teams, drivers giving it their all to go and win that championship. So if Mercedes are dominating, well done to them. I have nothing but respect for them. I tip my hat to them, and it's up to the rest of the pack to catch up. However, I don't want to see a point where Mercedes are, and we're changing the rules because Mercedes are so good. They're being punished for being good, and we'll try to let everybody else catch up. That, for me, is kind of is silly to do. And, you know, if you've got someone that's dominant, you have to respect that, and the onus is on you to catch up.
I completely agree with that, but isn't that the history of Formula One, though? If you're dominating, you get punished with a rules change. I mean, we shouldn't forget that Mercedes have already gone through a rules change because they were dominating too much, and they came out the other end still dominating. Ferrari saw a rules change when they were dominating. Red Bull saw the same. It seems to be cyclical, but every time one team seems to be dominating, Formula One seems to think the best thing to do is completely scrap the rule book and start again. Whereas actually, as we were discussing earlier, all this means is the teams get further spread out because the big teams have more money to divert towards researching a completely new set of rules that the junior teams, or sorry, not the junior teams, but the poorer teams just don't have the opportunity to do so.
One final point on this topic to round it off from my side, certainly, is that Mercedes are dominant just now. That is clear, and congratulations to them. But I can assure you, if they had the opportunity of being guaranteed the title at the end of the season, they would want it to be close with another constructor, because more fans are going to be engaged by that. They're going to get more press coverage. And that's just all about for Mercedes as a car manufacturer. They're wanting to sell more cars because people have lost interest by now in Formula One. But if they had a close battle, you know, everybody else is going to be more exciting. You're going to get more than just the hardcore Formula One fans watching to the end. And it makes it a much greater story for Mercedes to sell as a company.
Yeah, completely. And actually, you see it with Hamilton as well. I think Hamilton is dying to have a championship that he has to fight for. You know, obviously, 2008, he really had to fight for it. But ever since then, I think people have had this impression that he's walked it. Last year, I thought it was interesting how much, towards the end, he was trying to emphasize how tough a battle it was with Sebastian and Ferrari. Whereas no one really saw it as that. Everyone else saw it as a bit of a cakewalk. But he was determined to have a battle and to be seen as, you know, having fought for a title rather than having just had to beat Valtteri Bottas for it.
Guys, we're 12 rounds in this season's championship. I want to get both your thoughts on In terms of the constructors and who's impressed you and who we expect a little bit more from. Now, I think it's perhaps fair to say let's put Mercedes to one side, particularly given our recent conversations. So let's start with Ferrari. Did you expect them to be where they are at the moment? 288 points in the Constructors' Championship. Mercedes, 438. Fair to say they've got that championship round up. But guys, Ferrari came into this year off the back of this is going to be our season. Sebastian Vettel is going to do so well. We've got the next young star in Charles Leclerc. Everyone's hyped up for a strong year from the Maranello team. That hasn't quite happened. Why has that been the case? And can they turn it around in the second half of the season? Maybe not to the extent of a championship challenge, but to finish the campaign strongly. Adam, we'll start with you on that one.
Well, I think Ferrari have had a bit of a hard time this season. I mean, firstly, let's go back to pre-season testing. I mean, people were genuinely saying that they were half a second quicker than Mercedes. You know, that's not me just coming out with a random statement on Rock Radio. You know, they were proper people at the track who were analysing the test data, and that's what they came up with. I don't think it's been as bad a season as Ferrari in terms of the actual car. I still think they could have won in Bahrain, they could have won in Azerbaijan, they could have won in Canada, they could have won a couple of other races, but the problem is they've just lacked confidence. And I think after what happened in Bahrain, then to go on to China and Azerbaijan, Charles Leclerc, with his incident in qualifying, they were then coming into the European season having not won a race, and already the championship appeared over because Mercedes with a record-breaking start to the season with 1-2. I mean, it has been fairly embarrassing for Ferrari. You can't deny that. I expected Sebastian Vettel to be top of the championship at the start of the season after the Hungarian Grand Prix. That's not been the case. And this championship, I truly believe, could be a lot closer than what it is. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket science to work that out. I don't think it's been as one-sided as some people have made out. It's just Ferrari have not taken any opportunity this season.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. It, as much as this season has been dominated by Mercedes because they've been doing well, let's not forget Ferrari have done a really bad job as well at the other end. The car has had pace. They should have won in Bahrain, but you know, a reliability failure, which again, you just don't associate with the top teams these days, cost them the win then. Vettel's lost win in Canada. A couple of mistakes from Leclerc, but again, let's not forget his age, you know, they're to be expected. But that's all culminated in them being well off the pace. I think what's most concerning thing for them now is that it looks like Red Bull are overtaking them. You know, you start the season, as you said, with, you know, supposedly being half a second faster than Mercedes. Come the halfway point, it looks like you might be the third fastest team. I mean, they were miles off the pace in Hungary. And I know that track doesn't normally suit their car, but for Verstappen to be able to take a free pit stop and get the fastest lap because there was not a Ferrari driver within 25 seconds of him is ludicrous. They were just so far off the pace. I think they can only see this as a disappointment. And I think Binotto probably has quite a lot to answer for Maranello, because I don't understand. He was supposed to be bringing a change to Ferrari and things have only got worse.
Guys, I want to get your thoughts on one team who's perhaps flown under the radar a little bit in 2019. That's Alfa Romeo. Kimi Raikkonen moving to the team for this year. He's brought in 31 of the 32 points so far this season. They're seventh in the Constructors' Championship. Again, another team where we perhaps expected a little bit more from, particularly given Leclerc's fantastic season with them last year. But, you know, Raikkonen, we know he's a trusted hand, a very experienced driver, and he'll get you consistent results. We've not really had that from Giovinazzi. Yes, he's a young driver and all the rest of it, but things haven't quite gone to plan. I would have thought Alfa Romeo would have been looking at Toro Rosso and trying to get one over them this year, but that hasn't quite happened.
No, I think the big advantage that Toro Rosso have, that they, through good strategy, ended up getting a podium in Germany, courtesy of Daniel Kvyat, and also valuable points with Alex Albon in sixth place. So that's the problem in the midfield at the moment, is the way the point system works. If you have, you know, that one unpredictable race that we did this season in Germany under those conditions, it's those who are there to pick up the points, you could argue. And Toro Rosso had two of their drivers there, so that kind of puts them a bit out of joint. Toro Rosso, they've still done a good job this season, but for example, Renault are behind them, and I have to say Renault have been the biggest disappointment of the season so far for me. And Alpha, you know, they're sitting there in seventh. They had such a good start with Kimi Raikkonen scoring in the first four races, but then went three races without scoring. And since then, it's been a struggle. You know, Raikkonen, as you mentioned, has got 31 points. If Giovinazzi had the same, then all of a sudden, you know, they'd be a lot closer to the likes of McLaren at the front of the midfield. So Giovinazzi really needs to step up. Raikkonen's doing a terrific job.
Yeah, and as I said, I don't think we can state too much how brilliant a job Kimi Raikkonen's doing. You know, people questioning his motivation, why Sauber hired a driver, you know, who seemingly had nothing left to fight for in the sport. And yet he's dominated Giovinazzi, 8-4 in qualifying, 11-1 in races. And you kind of think, you know, it shows one, there's life in the old dog, yeah, but it shows exactly why they hired him. He's that wise head that team needs at the moment to get the points when the car is good enough. The problem is, in recent races, as you say, it's just not been good enough. I think the worrying thing for them is that they've been falling back compared to other teams, and they're going the wrong way down the grid, as you say, and they need to turn that around the second half of the season.
And guys, just the last team I want to get your thoughts on, Haas. Now, they've had a more interesting year off the track, I think it's fair to say, than what's been happening on the circuit. They're currently ninth in Constructors' Championship, just 26 points as well. It's been a very, very strange season. I want to know why. Kevin Magnussen started in Australia with that sixth place finish, but then it's all kind of gone downhill since then. Why is that the case, considering this is a team that, of course, ended 2018 fifth in the Constructors' Championship? Everyone expected to kick on from then. They've retained the same driver pairing in Grosjean and Magnussen, but there they are languishing well, you know, towards the bottom of the Constructors' Championship.
Yeah, I think that'll be the big interesting to see whether Magnussen and Grosjean, whether they'd remain teammates. I mean, they've had on-track collisions this year, which has not impressed Günther Steiner. For Haas, they just haven't understood their problems, have they? I mean, how many times this season have they had a terrific qualifying and you're thinking, right, they're going to get a great haul of points, but then in the race, they just drop backwards. It has been truly staggering. And what's even more staggering is they just simply do not understand the issues. And the amount of races that have gone by and they've been in a similar situation to the race before, where they've had good qualifying starts, yet they've gone backwards in the race. The race pace just hasn't been there. They're not understanding the tyres very well. And they scored a few points in Germany, effectively by default, by still being in the race. And apart from that, their last points finish, I think, was in Monaco with a 10th place finish. So that gives you a sign of the issues that Haas face, and it could be a very long second half of the season unless they sort these fundamental issues that they're clearly having.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing how one team can start off with, again, similar to Ferrari, look like a fast car, but they said they didn't understand the tyres. But as the season's gone on, it's looked more and more that they don't understand the car itself. It's never a good sign when one of your drivers asks if he can go back to the car that started the season, as opposed to the one that you've been developing over the last four races. But Romain Grosjean said, no, bring me the car that we used in race one in Australia, because I preferred that car to the latest iteration that they brought to Hungary. And they're now running the two against each other to compare. And there's not much difference in the two, which I think is, again, the more worrying thing. The one thing you should be expecting from updates is that they're improving the car, and they're not. And again, until they can solve that, then they can't trust anything they're bringing for the wind tunnel. They don't know if it's going to have a positive effect on the car. They seem completely lost at the moment.
Absolutely. Scott, always a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us on the show and chatting all things Formula One with us.
No worries, enjoyed it. Thanks, guys.
That's Scott Douglas from our friends at the Checkered Flag there. Stay with us as we talk all things MotoGP up next on Rock Sport Radio.
Love music. Live sport. Pole Position with Andy Alston and Adam Todd on Rock Sport Radio.
All right, let's take a quick look at all things MotoGP now before we move on to the World Rally scene, because we've got action at the British Grand Prix at Silverstone this weekend. Of course, last year's event was cancelled due to heavy rain. That proved to be one of the most controversial moments of the entire season. There was lots of debate around the relayed surface as well, of course, at Silverstone. And Adam, how important do you think it is, firstly, that this weekend for MotoGP in the UK is a good one? Because last year was certainly not a positive advert.
Definitely not. And MotoGP in the UK really has a strong following. And in the past few years in MotoGP have been so exciting. And it's a great opportunity to really get the British crowds behind MotoGP, and those who perhaps haven't watched MotoGP GP before to get involved with it, because traditionally the UK has been more of a Formula One country than the likes of Spain and Italy, who have big MotoGP followings. So there was a real opportunity. And last year, you know, you just remember seeing all the crowds who had stayed loyal throughout the day. And let's not forget, it wasn't just the MotoGP race. Of course, it was Moto3 and Moto2. And, you know, they wait all day long. And, you know, it was just dreadful to see all the fans. And obviously they get the tickets refunded, but then you've got to take into account accommodation. So it's critical that this weekend it all goes well. The weather forecast looks good, which is great. And they've all resurfaced the track as well, because obviously there's drainage issues. So it looks as if everything should go according to plan this weekend.
But will it be a weekend that goes according to plan for Marc Marquez? Because yes, he's got a 58-point lead in the standings. He hasn't won this event since 2014.
Yes, interesting actually. This race has been one of the more unpredictable races in MotoGP, because since 2013 we have had five different winners and five races. Of course, last year's cancelled, but in 2017 it was Ducati's Andrea Dovizioso. He won the last race in Austria, so Ducati are coming here fairly confident that they can challenge for victory. That victory in Austria came at the right time for the team that was just struggling. They had high hopes for Dovi to challenge for the title. That's not worked out. The year before was Vinales, who was on the Suzuki back then. He's now at Yamaha. Valentino Rossi in 2015 won in the Yamaha. It'll be interesting to see how Yamaha get on here. There are signs since the summer break that they are starting to make small improvements. They'll be aiming for victory. Marc Marquez won in 2014. It was Jorge Lorenzo in the Yamaha in 2013. Speaking of Lorenzo, he's back for this race. He's not been in MotoGP since his crash in Assen, where he broke parts of his back. It's been a horrific year for Jorge Lorenzo. There's no other way to put it at Honda. I think it's just 19 points he's got in the championship at the moment. And, you know, Stefan Bradl, who deputised for him at a few races, he's got 16. So he's only 3 points behind and he's only done four races. So for Lorenzo, how will he adapt to the bike? That's been the big question. You know, this season's effectively a write-off. You know, if he gets a few top 10 finishes between now and the season, that's progress. And he's kept his, he's decided to keep his honor his contract, and he's going to be at Honda next year, because there was talk I'm going to Pramac Ducati. So, you know, we could be looking here at a year and a half just completely written off Jorge Lorenzo. It's such a shame, because on that Yamaha, he was so competitive. But I suppose he'll say to himself, well, look at Rossi, Vinales. The Yamaha's not a championship-winning bike at the moment.
And Adam, just a quick word on Cal Crutchlow, because he'll be open for a good display in front of his home crowd. Fair to say he's probably had a bit of a mixed season so far. So is there any hopes of a podium finish for Cal this weekend?
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that any racetrack we go to, Cal always does have a chance of a podium, and he'll be doing everything he can to try and make sure that he's got the chance to please the British crowd. I mean, Cal's done fantastic work for MotoGP in this country. He's won races. And all the on the LCR Honda this season started off so well in Qatar with that podium, and we're thinking he's going to really challenge for race wins and regular podiums, but he's only had one other podium since then. That came in Germany. But, you know, in the British Grand Prix, who knows what can happen. British rider, it would be great for the sport, especially after the debacle of last year and what happened there with the cancellation, if we had a British rider on the podium at the British Grand Prix.
All right, let's move on to the rally stage now, because the World Rally Championship returns to tarmac this weekend, with the action heading to Germany for the 10th round of the season. Toyota's Ott Tanak leads away on 180 points, with Citroën's Seb Ogier second on 158 points, and Hyundai's Thierry Neuville just 3 points behind. Now, Tanak has won four events this year, and he's won the last two outings at Rally Deutschland as well. So is the stage set for another return to the top step of the podium this weekend? Well, joining us to look ahead to the action is rally expert David Halley. David, Tanak must go into this one as the favourite, but what does he do to try and manage expectations here, ensure that he gets that car round the entire route and crucially to the top step of the podium?
When we get to Germany, we mentioned Hinkelsteins, those enormous concrete blocks at the side of the tracks for Saturday afternoon, where so much damage can happen. You can destroy a car very quickly by getting a little bit offline. Yes, it's as we know, in any event, it's about getting the thing to the end. And he's won it twice in the last 2 years, as you say. So he knows his way around. They are running the Panzerplatter stages in the opposite direction this year, just to spice things up a little bit. And those stages are breaking up quite badly. So they're not the smooth tarmac that they get through the vineyards earlier in the event. A very interesting event. We've had the first stage tonight. Ott has already eked out a tiny lead, but it was a short spectator stage at the start. And we'll see how it goes for the rest of the weekend.
David, do you think the tarmac will be a little bit of a leveller for some of the teams, in so much as, of course, much of the calendar, of course, consists of gravel events? We've got tarmac in Corsica, but will that help the likes of Citroën and M Sport challenge the challenge for honours?
Seb Ogier was certainly very quick in the shakedown. He took the quickest time on the shakedown stage today, and Esa-Pekka Lappi was third with Ott in second. So yes, Citroën seems to be responding well to the smooth tarmac. The Saturday afternoon is going to be really interesting, because although it's tarmac and the cars are in a tarmac specification, the Panzerplatter, which is a tank training ground, is breaking up quite badly. So it's not the smooth tarmac. It's a very, very lumpy, bumpy, broken tarmac and concrete surface, which may bring up some of the shortcomings in some of the cars. The M Sport car, as we know, is very good on tarmac, but we have Gus Greensmith in his first outing in the second car on tarmac. He's had a couple of gravel outings, both of them having a problem with flying. He's got a small chance to do some flying on this event. Let's hope he can keep it all together, but it is his first time out on tarmac in a world car.
Definitely, I'm looking forward to seeing how Gus gets on, David. He's a very talented driver, as you mentioned, that we know that car is quick. I want to get your thoughts on Timo Suninen in that other M Sport car, because probably fair to say that we expected a little bit more from him at his home outing in Finland last time out. What does he do in terms of that team this weekend to, of course, not just lead them to a positive result? Because we know there's a quick driver there. Fifth place in Corsica, of course, earlier on in the year as well.
He has to, again, it's all about getting the car to the end of the event, which we know is the same for everybody. Somebody will have a problem during the event. So, yes, he has to be quick and get it to the end. And that's a very difficult balance to strike. Hopefully he's got the skill set to get that car to the top end of the leaderboard while still keeping it on the island.
David, Citroën bringing an engine upgrade to this one. It comes at a timely moment for Seb Ogier as well, I suspect, you know, given the gap that he has between him and Tanak at the top of the standings. If Ogier gets a positive result here this weekend, you know, we've only got four events after that one as well. I don't want to use the phrase make or break, but how crucial is this event for Ogier and indeed Nuyvo in the driver standings?
Well, for the first time, there's a significant gap to Ott at the top of the standings. In previous events where Seb or Thierry have had a problem, Ott has had a late problem as well and hasn't been able to stretch the gap. The gap's been niggling away in single figures or just into double figures for the whole season. This 20-plus point gap is quite significant this late in the season. But again, Ott can have a problem and Seb wins it and suddenly we're back into a much closer situation. It is so open. I wouldn't rule either of them out of the championship even at this late stage. There's so much more events to come and so much mileage for things to go wrong.
David, Chris Meek is one of the only full-time drivers who doesn't have a podium finish to his name so far this year. He heads into this event, and it's one that, when you look at the stats, it's not really been a positive hunting ground for him. Of course, he didn't take part last year, retiring in 2017, not in 2016. You go further and back, you look at his stats, it's not been a good event for him. What do you think his mindset will be going into Rally Deutschland?
Well, we remember last time out that he had to appear in front of the headmaster with his jotters down his trousers for going after Ott in Finland and damaging the car and putting himself out of the event. If he wants to continue in the World Championship, he's got to start getting cars to the end of events and then results may come. To finish first you've got to finish. If you take a wheel off it, then you're very unlikely to finish first. And Chris, throughout his career, has been been very much a case of being very, very fast, about being either unlucky or just putting things in the wrong place and causing more damage to the car than anybody else who happens to encounter a similar problem. It's just it's heartbreaking to see the effort he puts in and the trouble that he managed to cause himself. He has to screw the nut at some point or he won't be going much further.
David, when I was doing my work ahead of the show this week, I was thinking about Thierry Neuville and how I would describe his season so far, because going into 2019, we felt it was, you know, he was going to be strong, he was going to be there or thereabouts. Started off strongly, of course, with a second place finish in Monte Carlo, gets a couple of back-to-back wins in Corsica and Argentina. But for me, it almost feels like we've had a bit of a different Thierry this year. For some reason or another, you could put it perhaps down to Chile, but do you get the impression that he's maybe that there's something quite lacking, or is it perhaps just down to the out and out brilliance of Tanak?
I think Ott is putting everybody else in the shade. We know that Ott came close last year. He worked very hard on that car, and we talk about seat time, we talk about having the car how you want it. Ott has worked that Toyota incredibly well. And when you look at the promotional event in Estonia, where Ott was absolutely flying, making a mess of everybody, he's very confident in the car, and that's what you need. You need a car that's not going to do something unexpected underneath you. Thierry has you know, he's keeping pace with Seb. I just think that Ott is a little bit a level above, but it can all go wrong on one corner. We've seen it so many times that one corner can just change a championship.
David, let's take a little look back at the Ulster Rally from last weekend. Now, Craig Breen, of course, winning overall, clinching the Irish Tarmac title as well.
He did. Craig, as we know, has not been in the World Rally Championship other than Finland this year, and he has put himself in as many cars as he can just to keep his name in front. He was in a Hyundai, an R5 car, which is the specification for the Irish Tarmac Championship, and he has won that championship outright, which is absolutely superb for him. And he's getting a run out in the Hyundai World Car in Wales Rally GB as well. So he's probably going to be in with a shout for a drive next year. Second place overall, which is very impressive for Matt Edwards in the M Sport Swift Go Fiesta, taking a big lead in the British Championship now because Tom Cave had a small whoopsie at the end of the event. So Matt drove incredibly well, and he was kept on a rein. Not allowed to go chasing Craig. He could have probably given Craig Breen a bit more competition. We don't know how much Craig was just maintaining the gap, but Matt was on a mission to get maximum British Championship points, not necessarily to chase for the outright win. So a very good event for both of these guys.
And finally, guys, it's that time, prediction time, going back to the World Rally Championship. David, you're 2-1 up, so we'll give Andy a chance. Andy, you can start this time.
Thanks very much. it would be obvious to say Tanak, wouldn't it? So do you know what? I'm not going to say that.
Are you sure you want to do this?
No. Do you know who I would like to have picked? Would have been Elfyn Evans. I genuinely think he could have gone and won it. I would love to have said Elfyn Evans. I think Seb will do it. I think Ogier is going to win it because we know how good a driver is, and we know that when he's under pressure and he's got to pull out that performance, he will do just that. It's a massive weekend for Ogier. Citroën have made some changes behind the scenes in terms of that engine upgrade. Lappi, of course, I think will be important in terms of supporting an overall event win. I think Ogier will do it. Yeah, I'm going to say Seb.
David, what about you?
I'm going with Ott. I just feel he's got the wind beneath his wings, if you want to pick a phrase. I think he is the form man at the moment. So let's see if he can hold it together and get three in a row in Germany and another win for this season.
I think Andy might regret, because he did say Ott initially, so we'll find out next week whether he lives to regret that choice.
I've got to gamble. I'm trailing in the standings, man. You know. Right, okay, we'll leave it at that, guys. David, always a pleasure. Thanks very much for your time here on Pole Position.
No problem. We'll find out who did best guess next week.
Probably not me. David, thanks.
But as we say, one corner can change everything. You just never know.
That's that. All right, David. That's great stuff. Thanks very much. That's rally expert David Halley joining us on Pole Position.
Now let's find out the latest from the Scottish scene by getting the Superfast Scots roundup with Glenn Alcock.
Hi guys, and hello to everyone who's listening. So have a wee look back first. So in the BTCC, it wasn't the best weekend at Thruxton for Rory Butcher. After a great 7th place in race 1, race 2 he finished 14th and unfortunately never made the start of race 3 due to a failed clutch. Adam Moffat had a challenging weekend too in his new Infiniti Q50 with a 16th, 18th and 21st, but he's positive about the new car, saying we learned a lot and are closing the gap. So both Scots will be looking forward to Knockhill on the 14th and 15th of September, and you can get tickets from knockhill.com. SMRC news, so that Formula Libra date change had been planned for the next round on the 1st of September, but due to Formula Junior also being scheduled for that event, the decision has been made to separate the classes due to the sort of performance differences. It should be exciting to see what cars take part in October. So you've got all types of single-seaters with the exception of Formula 1 and Formula 3000 cars permitted, so it'll be interesting to see what we get out on track there. Lark Hall, so talking about the SMRC, the race against dementia, the SMRC are having a team, so a few good friends of mine will be competing. So Sandy Mitchell, the Blancpain GT driver, Jordan Gronkowski, who's currently leading Scottish Formula Ford, Ryan Smith, who leads the Scottish C1 Cup, and we'll also have Robbie Dalgleish, who's leading the Celtic Speed Mini Cooper Cup. So it's a very strong lineup. It'll be great to see how the guys get on at the endurance race, and that is on a week today. In the news as well, we've got 8-year-old Aston Sharp, so he's the youngest ever cadet to win at the Scottish Kart Championships. He's from Aberdeen. He's been karting since he was 4 years old, and he's been racing at Banff and the Grampian Karting Club. His father, Ryan Sharp, had a successful career winning in Formula Renault World Series and also in World GT, so we'll keep an eye on his progress for the future. Ross Wylie had a good weekend at Silverstone in the GT Cup, driving his Ferrari 488 GTC with a 4th in class and 8th overall, and he currently sits 2nd in the GTC category. There's 1 week today to the official opening ceremony for the new Jim Clark Motorsport Museum, and there's still time to win that limited edition Jim Clark Lotus Evora for £20, so check out the Jim Clark Trust page for details on that. Knockhill Motorsports Club and the Scottish Championship bike racing this weekend, so the 2019 Sidecar Jock Taylor Trophy race, and there'll be tickets on knockhill.com. We get 32 races split over the Saturday and the Sunday this weekend, and there's good weather forecast, so that makes all the difference, especially for bikes. Knockhill Motorsports Club's also looking for marshals, so check them out on Facebook and get in touch if you're interested. Obviously, marshalling is vitally important for motorsports to actually take place. And the Scottish Borders Council is backing plans for the return of the Jim Clark Rally this year on November 8th and 9th. The organisers of the rally have been given the go-ahead, but they've got to just get the final sign-off from the council, so things are looking good for that. And that's all I've got.
Absolutely. And Glenn, just a quick word on Rody Butcher, because it was a challenging weekend for him. He was going in there, third in the standings as well, and it was just a weekend to forget. It's such a crucial moment as well.
Yeah, I think so. But, I mean, as we all know, unfortunately, that's motorsport, isn't it? You know, it can be a kind of cruel mistress at times, and things can be going your way, and then all of a sudden it's turned on its head, literally, like with me that time. But other times, you know, you can maybe not be having the best weekend, and then you can salvage a good result out of it. So back on, you know, home turf for the next round, I'm sure that him and Aidan, especially, you know, what the weather was like, obviously, for last year's BTC race, it'll be interesting just to see how the guys get on, but I'm sure Rory will be doing everything he can to try and get himself as high up the championship standings as he can. But what a season he's had.
Absolutely, Glenn, thanks very much as always for your time here on Pole Position.
Thank you very much.
That's the Superfast Scots roundup there with Glenn Alcock. Adam, we mentioned Rory Butcher there and the challenges he had last weekend. A quick word for Aidan Moffat, who Glenn referenced there earlier on. He's of course made that switch to the Infiniti Q50. We had him on the show a few weeks back, and he was saying, you know, the end of 2019 is very much a bit of testing for him. But a very talented young driver in there, goes into, of course, his home race at Knockhill coming up in the next few weeks. If he gets a good bit of seat time in that car, who knows what next year will bring for him.
Yeah, definitely. And I think Aidan was quite impressed, actually, albeit he didn't score points at Snetterton, with how the car felt. And he was quite impressed just how close they got to finish in the points. And obviously at the weekend, again, it's just about getting used to the car and familiarising himself with it and getting the most out of the package, which, looking ahead to next year for sure. But at Knock Hill, always a great venue, of course. Let's hope it's a lot warmer than last year. But crowds were fantastic. They always are in Scotland for Scottish motorsport. It's one of the best days, if not the best days, on the Scottish motorsport calendar. So that will be great. And it would be great if we can see Rory and Aidan putting in some strong results. And what an opportunity for Rory as well this time in Knock Hill to bounce back as well after the disappointment of Thruxton, because he is capable of winning races this season, as we've saw, won twice before, who wouldn't rule out a home victory.
No, absolutely, and that would be great to see as well. Of course, the action 14th and 15th of September at Knock Hill for the next round of the British Touring Car Championship. And unfortunately, that's all we've got time for on Pole Position this week, but we'll be back from 8 o'clock next Thursday night to do it all again. My thanks to Adam, to our guests, and to you for joining us as well. Stay tuned for the Rock Zone coming up next, right here on Rock Sport Radio.
Love music. Live sport. Pole Position with Andy Alston and Adam Todd on Rock Sport Radio.